upcoming assignments and how they relate to the content of the book. And I also thought that maybe I'd do a quick recap of the design thinking concept. And for those of you who were not here last time, I have put together the slides, but the file was too big, so I couldn't send it with email. But I think I hope that Fredrik can help me to get it up. So it should be there very recently. Just couldn't transport it. So today we start with the main literature for the course, and it's a number of stories put together from a specific position, a specific location, and at a specific time. So the stories are basically, they emanate from Malmö in which is in the south of Sweden, in two ways. It's in the way that the researchers and designers associated who tell these stories, they are all in one way or another associated with the School of Arts and Communication and the Media Collaborative Media Center at the school. And the stories take place during the last 5 to 10 years. And they are stories that, as you remember from the prologue, try to evoke other heres and nows, others, ways of understanding innovation, other ways of understanding what role design could play in the democratization of society. It's they're set at a specific time where in Malmö, since Malmö is in Sweden, since Sweden is in the Nordic country, we could say that the welfare state is under attack. It's not something that is as taken for granted as before, and it's I mean economically reacted in many ways through neoliberal pursuits, but I would think that a lot of young people don't believe in it anymore. So there's also a kind of mistrust. I mean, people, Sweden used to have, for instance, trade union organization where more than 80% of the workforce, 90% of the workforce was part of a union. It's not so obvious anymore. It used to be that no one wanted to pay high taxes, but it used to be that it seemed that you actually got something from it. But now actually taxes has been lowered quite a bit in Sweden, and that's the way it's going. And it used to be that borders were quite open, and people coming from other countries, also in since World War II, has really helped to build this country. And people came from Italy, from Finland, from Turkey, etc. The welfare state would not have been possible without these people coming. But now there is a stronger, with also maybe because so many people are coming now, there are this is not as obvious anymore, and there's a number of changes in society. And as we talked about, when the tradition that we are part of, when it started, it was very much focused around the workplace. And as when we went through the history about what could people locally do at the workplace when typically new technology, as it's called, or new media, we'll probably say today, are introduced in the workplace. Do they have a say on that? And how should and could design in any way contribute in the process of creating alternatives? Whereas, as we noticed, that the battlefield is maybe much more now moved from the workplace. Not to say that there isn't class struggle at work. I guess, especially those of you, many young people, even well-educated, will be what we now call precarious workers. Many of you will not get a permanent position with someone from my generation. So there's also things that were changing at the workplace. But the question of how public space, public engagement, of how the everyday life becomes an arena of innovation and change, and what kind of role can design have in that? That seems where we've been moving in this last decade, and the book, even if participatory design or co-design has had its work in focus in the workplace, focuses on these new arenas of design and try to see what's the role of design in opening up something like that. So let's say that Sweden and the city of Malmö, and as you'll see, I'll talk about it in a bit, the city of Malmö, it's not a big city by world standards. We are about a bit less than 300,000 people. But it's interesting because within these 300,000 people, they come from more than 170 countries. So it's a quite diverse city. It's also a segregated city, and I'll come to that later on. But it's the question is, remember in the prologue, Lucy Suchman anthropologist of technoscience, thank you, reported from Silicon Valley in 1995, listening to national radio, and they're saying, the future arrives sooner here. And she uses this to say that how, by repeating this over and over again, Silicon Valley becomes the center of innovation, and the certain kind of high-tech young entrepreneurial type of innovation becomes very much synonymous with innovation. Technology, fast, young, very entrepreneurial, often building really big consortia, that becomes what innovation is. And you'll also talk about the proximity of Stanford University, all the tech companies and all the startups, etc. And so people meet and the great ideas. So the question with the book is are there, could one think about other locus for innovation, say, than Silicon Valley? And Laura Watts from Orkney Island asked if, for instance, could a place as much in the periphery as Orkney Island be part of where the future is made? And so the book starts with, does anyone here speak Swedish? No, because then I can see. This has to be said in the local dialect of Malmö. And I'm not from Malmö, so I cannot say it correctly. But it goes something like this. How is it Malmö? How is it Värde? Which translated, it says, if you've seen Malmö, you've seen the rest of the world. Very cocky kind of saying, and which appeared starting in the mid-90s. And that was when Malmö, the city of Malmö, was in total chaos. We had a big ship war, that were closing down. That were the biggest working place. The textile industry had already closed down. We're supposed to get a car factory that just started up but closed down before even any cars came out of it. And the economy in the city was hopeless. But there was some really interesting underground culture life. The culture life was, even if local, was on high international level. Museums, etc., could really conquer the Copenhagen and Stockholm in many ways. So, and this is, when this is said, this is when there is a shift in the city. And this shift in the city has a number of political strategy. It says that Lund, where these students in there had been visiting, is an old university, 24 kilometers from Malmö, or is it 22? They used to, and I used to be a professor there before moving to Malmö, and they usually say that the distance between Malmö and Lund is the orbit of the Earth minus 22 kilometers. So everything was very academic life, and this, I mean, a really good university, one of the three best universities in Sweden, built in 1500 something, etc. But there was no spread over to the city of Malmö. And so in this new strategy was the question, could this be a more knowledge-intensive city? And one part of that was to set up a new university, and I had the fortune to be asked to be part of doing that and doing the School of Arts and Communication, or how to bring design and new media, etc. So I jumped on that bandwagon and became part of that from the beginning, liking the challenge of the possibility of doing something that made a difference. In Lund, there's only 50,000-60,000 people, and more than half of them are students. So it's a very different setup. It was the decision to build a university, and not as here a university that lies far out, but in the very center of the city. So that was part. The other idea was that what if the city of Malmö was more connected to the surrounding to Europe? And so there was this decision to build a bridge between Malmö and Copenhagen. Copenhagen is just across the sea, also 24 kilometers away. So there was built a bridge.
When was it?
In 2000. The bridge was finished in 2000. And the bridge is the bridge in the bridge. So, you know, the murder just in the middle of the bridge. So that's the bridge. And it turns out, actually, but that's another story, that the TV series, the bridge, has probably made more to make this region known than anything else that's ever been done. But that's a side story. And it was also decided to try to have a more open climate for IT and media industry, so setting up incubators and so on. So all this was done, and the city gradually got better and better. We got the university, we got the bridge, we got a quite blooming IT and media industry, a cluster of companies, and quite often associated with the university. I guess like in 20, like here probably. The city decided that it wanted to be a sustainable city. When the new area where the university was put, the old Western Harbour where the wharf had been, was declared to be a sustainable part of the city, so was another part. And green tech become really what was hot in Malmö. So. And when the city itself describes its today, it does perhaps not say, if you've seen Malmö, you've seen the rest of the world. It describes itself in terms of this multicultural, sustainable, green, high-tech, new media hub. And so the question is... and that is one picture of the city, and it's very much the official picture. But then, for instance, if we go to media, there will often be a very different picture. Take Fox Television. Fox Television, when they Television, they would point out that there are gang-related killings. There are burnings of cars and of houses. Hello. It's a dangerous city, and this is very much related to ethnic conflicts. So that's another. So the question is, which picture is true, or if one can talk about something as a true picture, what is the background? So how would design work if the first picture is okay? Does it just mean that if the first picture is there, that that one has to really join with the media, IT, green tech companies, and the university, and it will all be fantastic. Or if one believes the Fox News, then maybe you should move to Lund or even further away. That would be more safe and as a designer. There's not much for a designer to do in this surrounding. And then a couple of years ago, we had a commission that looked into the living conditions in the city of Malmö. There have been national such commissions in, I don't know if there's been in Holland actually, but several countries have had it, to look at living conditions more generally. And maybe their picture more worth working. And I said they were researchers, scientists, politicians, and citizens sitting in their boat. And I think their conclusion is that things has become so much better during since the mid-90s over 20 years. Living conditions have improved in many ways, and social and economic, socially and economically and culturally, there's been a real progress. But at the same time, they have indicators that disturbs this picture. So, for instance, they notice that if you live in the low income, typically immigrant areas of the city, your average life expectancy is 5 years lower than if you live in the middle of the city or in wealthier neighborhoods. If you have a higher education, as you guys, and compared to just the basic school, same difference. More than 5 years difference in life expectancy. So these are kind of disturbing indicators that something is not really well, even if almost every parameter points in a positive direction. There's also a growing difference between people in terms of access and expectance and life and living conditions. So, and I think that's where and their recommendation they come with. I think it's 102 recommendations or something like that. But basically, they suggest for the city what they call a social investment policy, more democratic forms of innovation and governance through citizen participation. So that's their conclusion of what is needed. And that's quite interesting for us, because, I mean, we've started to work much earlier, but it turns out that this is exactly the kind of direction where we have been looking for design openings in closing the gap. We did not call it a social investment policy or anything that we call it maybe democratic design experiments. But basically, this is the map, the territory in which. These design experiments evolve, and here's a. I take this in a bit different order than I normally do, but I think now we started with the city, so we go on a little bit. Malmö is quite interesting because it does not have suburbs really. It has different boroughs or different parts of the city, but it's not. It's all quite connected. And over here, up in the corner, up there, that's where the university is. That's where all the IT and media companies are. That's where that's the hub for the creative class. So this is the university, the IT and media companies, a number of culture producers, the center for the creative class is down there. This is in the very middle of the city, Möllevången, that used to be
It's now a gentrified area. It used to be where young culture was expanding, a strong multi-ethnic area, and now quite gentrified. And out here we have Rosengård and Fossier and the big the areas with high-rising buildings built in the 70s and onwards, and where most immigrants live. So our interventions with our design thinking, our design labs, they have been focusing in these three areas. This one doesn't matter. This was down there on the picture. So this is Rosengård and Fossier and the low income multi ethnic area. We work in many ways, but our basic strategy for the infrastructure or design thing has to be working with what we had called living labs. And I guess several of you are familiar with the concept of living labs. And it's been very pushed by the European Commission and in different programs, etc. And I think we're only kin to most of the living labs in name, but not in ways of being and acting. So a typical living lab often takes the point of departure that users are important, and they often have the form of some kind of user testing. You bring a product and you get a user tested. Maybe you go as far also as you do it in the very environment where the users live. Our living labs does more take on the strategy of design thinking. So it's long-term engagement, building on trust that's built over time, building a lot of networks of actors, being attentive to whatever opportunities that come up, rather than building a specific product or service. And the way it's set up, if we started with us, part of it, at the university, so we're a group of researchers, designers, teachers, and students. Students are not part of all projects, but on very many projects. So when there is an engagement as teachers, we would typically see if there is a class that this could fit for and their assignment and they will be part of it. A lot of master students, of course, also do the master thesis as part of one of these engagements. So that's one group, but it always starts with, in some way, active citizens and a contact with active citizens that one pursue one or another agenda. But it builds networks with active citizens are the way that's been for us, and then maybe that's one of the limitations. It's very often been through the collaboration with an NGO, with a local NGO or one kind of another. So build relation with and through the NGO. But with that said, as a basis, active citizens, our design lab and the NGO, in our network, we also have a number of potential companies, IT and media companies, former students, for instance, that have set up an interaction design company or a media company or etc. So it's all very often looking for how could their competence be built into it in building a network. And institutions that are part of it, depending on not only the university but also others, again depending on specific project, and even as far as to incubators, if it comes to that in the end. It hasn't happened a lot, but it has happened. And then we have tried, and that's been another long-term aspect of this, to build relations with civil servants in the city of Malmö, not only from the environmental department, from the urban planning department, from health department, from social work, etc. And that's been an ongoing process in building up these networks. So that's the way. So that's why when I was talking about it the other day, I did not talk about projects, but about having these labs as some kind of vehicles or hubs through which this networking is being performed when opportunities arise. And I'll do some detail on it later on. And when we started out with these labs in 2007, the first lab seen the stage was situated in Möllevangen, in this in the middle of the city, this culture hub, and in collaboration with a culture center, a multi-ethnic culture center. In that hub, but as time has been going on, the lab does not at all only sit in Möllevangen, but makes networks all over the city and also beyond the city. That lab, in many ways, led to setting up. Yeah, you're just stretching yourself when you're asking questions. It's a good question. In this case, it was a place called Inkonst to the very beginning, which is this culture center. But very soon, it more became a network of people, which in some way were partly governed by us in terms of bringing it together. And so, for instance, one of the major groups here, a group that I'll talk about in a bit, called Gatans Röst och Ansikte, the voice and face of the street, which is a group of youngsters led by a hip-hop hip-hop artist and political activist who joined, basically started out of being interested in hip-hop music, but then broadened into very many other areas. So they became, in a way, the basis of the next lab, which was placed in Rosengård, but without a physical space, with a number of physical. We negotiated for a long time with about a physical space, which was a center that part of the city owned for citizens, but couldn't agree on the conditions, and was also who wanted to come there and who would not come if the other were coming, and so on. So it became more a network where the hubs out there would be, for instance, the youth organization, it would be where in their facility, or with the women from the women's association that we talked about the other day, and I'll talk more about it today, that it was with where they had their facilities. And in terms of Birmingham, if we come to it, I'll tell a story about that. You think that these are very, very harmless kind of design activities, but they are still full of ethical questions in terms of, for instance, that their facilities, the women's facilities, were burned down twice. And the only thing that was stolen the second time was the register of members. And they were really, really scared. But you can also put ethical questions. Had we a role in this happening? And I will not go into a discussion of who did it, etc. But it's just, yeah. So even if this seems like very low tech, very low impact, etc., it's maybe more to it than that. Did that answer your question?
So it's a group and different physical space.
And then when we go to the factory Fabriken, it's probably Fabriken in something like in Dutch also, or yeah,
okay.
Fabrika. Fabriken is a makerspace, and so we wanted also to work with Fab Labs makerspace, etc., and see. Or makerspace more generally, and see what could, is there a new role for design in the opening of production there? And unfortunately or fortunately, the geographical location, this has a geographical location, or had it to start with, now it's spreading. But that is just 200 meters away from the university, and with all the IT and media companies around it, but I will see pictures in a bit. It's quite interesting because it's a part of the old shipyard. It's called the staple. I don't know what that would be in English actually, but where a slope, and under that slope there were the closed rooms and restaurant, not restaurant, but eating place for the workers. So that, with support from the city of Malmö, has been rebuilt into this makerspace. But you could say, so it's kind of interesting. On the one hand, what does it mean that it is, one, so close to the university, two, in the media hub, and 3 kilometers away from that place. What are the consequences of that? I think maybe we can talk a little bit about that as well. So these were and when you look at the cases in the book, they go across the division here in the four division into four areas here in many ways. So it's not big like that. So this is. So I think that one might say that the challenge, as pushed forward by the Malmö Commission, or as we saw it, had to do with a critique, not only of Silicon Valley, not saying that we can do things better than Silicon Valley. I'm sure we cannot. It's a fantastic place for newness, for innovation understood as producing universal novelty products. But it is maybe to say that when someone like Erik von Hippel talks about democratizing innovation, meaning that innovation has been democratized for a couple of reasons. For instance, because now there are cheap tools, or maybe even for free tools for everyone to make products, typically digital tools. And there are networks through the internet, there are connections so that everyone can get in access with whom they need to get in access with to innovate. So you get a virtual proximity, and typically, in von Hippel's view, this opens up for lead users, be them the first to find out about mountain bikes or the first to find out about something else, and building business around that. And there's nothing wrong with that, but it's like it's typically white young males who are part of this innovation. Not to say it's only, but it's and they're very smart and they deserve all the progress and it's not to critique them, but to say that maybe there's more to it than that. Maybe there's something that is a little bit less fast, a little bit slower, something that is maybe not a novel product, but an opening up for a new practice, very mundane. So instead of looking at this design as the design of novel products, the idea is much more to open up, see, in the very context where something is going on, could the design intervention, the design experiment, open up some kind of, even if there are small, new possibilities, and open up questions or controversies that have been locked before. So that's the vision of this utopia of this work. And so let's see if this will go. So, and this vision, it takes place conceptually in a landscape where we've had to learn a lot of new concepts. And again, I'm sure that you've come across many of them. But just to take a few here. We are arguing for that the kind of living lab, namely something that is networks that physical, place-based or network-oriented, but always focusing on issues that are important to people and building networks around that. That is one possibility worth exploring, but there are also many other views about what a living lab is. So when we say living lab Malmö, it doesn't say a lot of the story. We have, as we talked about, declared the heritage of from participatory design. I'm not going to talk about that more today, but also participatory design, as we can see, has some crisis, in the sense that, I mean, it developed into, on the one hand, the original ideas of trying to see could the workplace be a more democratic place, towards a set of very efficient, effective, useful tools and techniques for participation in any direction. So that enhanced participation, but maybe for another product to the market that might be needed or not needed. So I was struggling last time also to introduce the idea that it's not maybe the whole the whole idea of user-centeredness good objects and services is too limited, and try to introduce a framework where democracy and politics is not external to, but built into the understanding of what's going on. And if we have time towards the end, I try to do that a little bit better than I did last time. User-driven innovation, for instance, could in many ways be seen as, in around 2000, we had lots of EU programs and national programs, all fostering user-driven innovation, with, I think, two kind of inputs. One, you could say, the von Hippel kind of understanding of the importance of lead users, and in some way, maybe also the understanding of the general understanding also from co-design and participatory design that it is a very efficient way of reaching a goal to involve users. But as I said, it has this dilemma also that if, once you have users, you already have a product in mind or the envisionment of a product. So it's like, it seems like starting in the wrong end. Instead of starting with the issue, you start with the product and you find the user to that product. That's a lot of, and then there's a number of other concepts here that I will talk about more when we go through the examples in the book. I think most of them will be covered there. Maybe not triple helix. So, and the idea of triple helix, I think we did talk about it. But basically, this kind of, say, on the top alliances between the local university, the local or regional political governance and political sphere, and the local. Local industry in all different kinds of networks. And so you can see that when we, with the Living Labs, it's a bit like that, but rather trying to start in building that bottom up instead of top down. So in the book, we have divided these cases in four areas. and for each of these areas, there is an introductory chapter that talks about what are the challenges, what are the conceptual framework to think about this. And then it works through two or three cases within that area and see how concepts are applied there and challenged also. I mean, it's not a book with one set of concepts that bring it all together, but concepts also get challenged as we go along. But there are a few ideas that are holding together, like the idea of infrastructure in some of the ideas from feminist technoscience and the core ideas of participatory design. So the first area, we'll start with it after the break. The first area we've called designing conditions for the social, and it deals with, you could say, very roughly, with the idea of social innovation. What is design for social innovation? And especially, what is the relation between citizens and city in this, and can design have a role in that? So we'll talk about that. The second area, so if one should talk in maybe old Marxist jargon, one would maybe say that the first one has to do with opening reproduction, whereas the second one looks at opening up production on the idea that there are or could be an alternative to the corporation, some other collaborative arrangement than the firm to produce, some other ways of looking at the production of value. Thirdly, the third area looks into cultural production, and tries to see what is this creative class that we are part of, and are there also differences, maybe class struggles within the creative class? And for instance, what's the view on labor? What kind of labor do you do in the creative class? What could design have a role in some way to be supportive to those marginalized in the culture production as it looks now? And the fourth field look at the public engagement or new forms of public engagement beyond the voting ritual that we do every third or every fourth year, and see could this be part of enhancing our democratic engagement or civil engagement in the development of the city. So these four are what we should talk about the next hour, and after that talk a bit more about how that links into the different assignments. And if we still have time and you think and you're not too tired, we do a second go on thinking. Something you want to bring up right now. So what I'm trying to do, I'm trying to give you the context for this city, this, say, and the movements in the city, and how this happens in neoliberal times. And so it's not to say that it's to say some very local things. It's not to say that things should be done this way in Twente, or in Inchede, or in Hong Kong, or in wherever. But there is a hope that by being enough specific with the stories, that they can make sense other places, and then people will need to appropriate it in their totally different ways there, with the constraints and the resources available. So it's not to say that Inchede or Hong Kong should do anything like this, but just to start to connect stories. So like in the prologue of the book, where we connect stories from Orkney Island and from the margins of Silicon Valley, we also towards the end of the book reaches out and look at, for instance, very interesting, very similar things happening many other places in the world. So it's more like being part of building this repertoire of stories that could maybe be part of forming another understanding of design and innovation.
I have a question, Pelle. Mm-hmm. Have you already came across another city or another region in the world that is also somehow in a similar movement than Malmö is going through? This kind of arrangement.
I'm sure there is. How should I put this? It's kind of when something takes. Is seen from or orchestrated from a design school or a university, we come to see it in one way. But as we were talking about the other day, many things like this happen, and maybe they are not at all associated with design school. It's social workers, it's architects, it's urban planners, it's teachers, and I think that there's a lot of such stories to link into. But when it comes in through academia, for instance, I then happen to know that there's a number of very similar stories in Copenhagen. That's only the 24 kilometers away. But then
then collected by the Danish Design School, and their kinds of collaboration and intervention, collaboration with citizens and interventions in the city. And in Holland, I mean, for instance, if you take something like makerspaces, Wach Foundation in Amsterdam is a really interesting example, very close to many of the things that we've been engaged with. So there, yeah, everywhere, I think. There is, we'll talk a little bit about it under social innovation, but also see that, yeah, that it could be put under quite different regimes. And another great source for this, and we'll talk about that after the break, is the network that has emerged from Politecnico in Milano and designed there, starting out with a work by Ezio Manzini, and then which they've had a number of projects on trying to map initiatives of collaborative services, for instance, in the regions, and they keep on, there's now an international network called DESIS. Have you come across DESIS? We'll come on the next picture. Design for Social Innovation and Sustainability, which try to gather examples. So DESIS. In Malmö, we are a DESIS lab. In Hong Kong, there's a DESIS lab. In Shanghai, there's a DESIS lab. I don't remember where in Brazil, but there is a DESIS lab in Brazil, and so on. And it's a very loose network, and maybe, again, since it comes in some way from academic and university, being boasted a bit more than, I mean, there's so many other things happening. 15 minutes break or 10 minutes break or what do you want? What? 15. We'll do 15 minutes break. Good. Under the heading of designing conditions for the social, there are two cases. One about an incubator for social innovation, and one about the case that we looked a bit at the film about a collaborative service developed together with the Herbos Women Association. But I thought in the introductory chapter, and there are a number of concept ideas that I just thought we should talk a little bit about, and I should remind you that I will not present the chapters here. I'll just highlight a few things because of two reasons. First reason is that on the 13th and the 23rd, we have seminars, critical seminars, to which you should have had read the respective chapters to the 13th, or if, is it the 11th? 11th. Okay. Now it's in the scheme. We'll have the first critical seminar, and
you should organize the groups, by the way.
Yes, that's been part of. So we do it and look at the kind of questions that I tried to suggest for your reading, and then we have a discussion on the 11th, and then there will be group assignments for and this will be on social innovation or social design, but then for the three others, you will be responsible for in groups to organize those seminars and take up and the questions we're going to discuss, and that will be on the 23rd. So that's one reason that we're going to go much more in detail with this in these coming critical seminars. And the other reason is, but to still say a little bit now, is that it could help you to start to think about, would I like to work with an assignment within which of these areas do I think there is something that an assignment that I could engage with in the surrounding here, and so you can start to think about that, and we can maybe talk a little bit about that already today, if you're thinking about some place, and also maybe see if that can help us start to organize groups.
Good. So signing conditions for the social. I think two backgrounds. There are many backgrounds possible, but one is it is an area of that you could say builds on the participatory design, co-design background, in the sense that it is about involving people in changing their everyday conditions. But I think the main theoretical framework and framing of this comes from the network DSIS, Design for Social Innovation and Sustainability, that, as I said, grew out of Politecnico in Milano and the design school, design department there, with as a key figure Ezio Manzini, who you could say is a bit like Kristen Nygaard in participatory design. He already had a career as one of the key figures in design and sustainability, and come to the conclusion that we cannot have environmental stability without sustainability without social sustainability. So that's his move into something that join forces with participatory design, and then they have a big group. Anna Moroni is one of the key persons there now. It's my age, so it's also kind of retiring a bit. And there is this really interesting network around this, as I said, with local groups in quite a number of countries. Yeah. I don't know about Holland, actually. I know in Belgium, and so you can say that is the basis for design for social innovation and sustainability. That group and their different writings, and they typically try to collect examples and share them, but in the beginning at least had a quite weak theoretical framework for this. They had some concepts that pop up here. But that was a quite good match in many ways. And Ezio is later this year coming out with a companion book to this one on the DSIS take on, and he's he
his as many mood towards resilience. But that's another story. So it will be about social innovation and design for social innovation and resilience.
And then we have a big field of social innovation that is not at all specifically related to design. I mean, that's the main areas not related to design. Often people engaged in social innovation would say, like, maybe a bit like you're saying, there are so many others that are doing it. What's so special about design in this? I think that designers would have to withdraw a little bit and say that maybe it's not so special, but hopefully there are some competences beyond facilitation that are interesting. And we'll come to that.
So
social innovation more broadly tries to deal with challenges in society, but does it in very different political versions or agendas. So, for instance, in the UK, early social innovation was, you could say, in a way, part of the Blair government when it turned neoliberal, and how could, so the question is, how could amateurs, citizens, be involved in solving social issues in the neighborhood, in the neighborhoods, and how could entrepreneurs, social entrepreneurs, help in doing that? So that's one version of design for social of social innovation, whereas others maybe look so. The critique of this approach, interesting as it is, with work by people like Charles Ledbetter on Proam and We Think, etc., really really great stuff in many ways, but it's very much become still part of big society in the meaning later on in the meaning of how can people solve things that the welfare state did before? If we're going to work with the minimal state, how can things be organized in some kind of a market way? So social innovation is also part of that in the one end, and in the other end, maybe something that tries to strengthen the welfare state. And then maybe it looks quite differently. So it's a spectrum. It's not one thing. And there's hundreds of definitions. I think we have five in the book. But basically, most of them goes about that it's design. It's innovation for something that is socially good for society, and it's also engaging with people in different ways. So it's participatory, I guess you should say. Yeah. But you can look at detailed definitions and discussions of that. It also, I guess, it focuses on social versus rather than technical design. So it's not, I mean, it could very well be a product or a service, but it focuses on a social challenge rather than focusing on a specific problem. There are lots of versions or strategies for theoretical fields trying to deal with social innovation. One is service design. I guess you probably have courses in service design here. Yes or no? You've taken courses in service design? No, but they are, yeah.
So service design is a real big field, which again maybe has to do with building. How could you have design consultancy that deal with these issues, and very close to participatory design in many ways, really interesting, focusing on the services needed, and I think that co-design, participatory design borrows a lot of features from service design, not least some of the techniques, but it's very much again seen, at least if we take the US, the UK context, as these companies that help keeping the state small, or the welfare state small. But really interesting. On the other hand, if we stay in the UK, where much of social innovation has emerged, there you also have the idea of transformation design, which is then much more done by projects initiated by the Design Council, and much more focusing on radical change of in terms of people's engagement and the urgency of the issues that are being looked at. So if one's in the UK, there is this, I don't know if you can call it a tension, but there are very different approaches in terms of transformation design versus service design. Another distinction, maybe, I mean, just picking out a few things from the introductory chapter, is that one view on social innovation has to do with how a corporation can operate in the field, whereas most writers and those who reflect about it focus on that social innovation seem to rather need and build on the establishment of networks with different actors without a clear center of which is, and that of course fits very well with the idea of thinking in infrastructure, but focusing on the importance of building these networks. Design and social innovation, we have been talking about. So one way to that it's being put forward in the introductory chapter is to say that a way to try to understand what you want to do is to, in terms of design for social innovation, if it's, we call the Salvo's term, if you're working with design for politics or political design, in the sense that design for politics would typically be social innovation where you try to make better governance within the city, to support the governance system in being better. Whereas political design, the way DeSalva formulated, would more be a question of working with burning issues that come up in the city and with citizens engaged in that. And I don't know if it has to be the one or the other, but to say that social innovation could both be within the system, or it could be taking its point of departure in burning issues.
Philip, political design will be more like a designerly approach to politics?
No, both could be designerly, but I guess in the first case, you would say that, okay, we try to make the way that we operate, the social workers operate together together with citizens and with the politicians and with whatever, to make that work better. So I'm not suggesting there's anything wrong with it, but that is quite different than starting from, why do we have so many burnings, fires out in Rosengård, and who is concerned about it, and are there ways bottom up to organize and deal with that? I don't know if that's a good example, but just.
I'll talk about Powerful Stranger in a bit. And so the lab, the basic lab here has been the neighborhood in this field. We're working with trying to establish collaborative services of different kind. And we have these two cases, the social incubator and the one on collaborative services. So the case with the social incubator, how much did you say about it in the first day? Nothing or?
A little bit.
It shouldn't be long this time either, because the time is running away.
But the design assignment here was a design assignment from the city of Malmö to build an incubator for social innovation, or propose an incubator for social innovation. And the way it was organized was to bring in 60 people for four workshops, where the key people were six groups that were had done interesting social innovation, like for instance the group of young people working with hip hop music, to the Women's Association that we'll talk about in a bit, to these guys who wanted to work on bicycle repair in the neighborhood, and also some exchange with their home country on electronics, and they were all guys from with a criminal background, So these people were the key actors, and then together with them there were key people from the city. There were researchers, there were NGOs, there were Save the Children, there were entrepreneurs, there were politicians, etc. And so you could say that. Some kind of given these examples, and from them start to ask the question, how could a social incubator help them develop their ideas and their so that was the first challenge. How could these six be supported in that? And from that start to generate. And what comes up is an idea, a vision that's called the incubator is out there. They did not want a physical place somewhere in the city where one should need to go to the social incubator. They wanted it to be out where, in the different suburbs where they were, and be built as network, could be an office of course, but as network of people already active in the suburbs. And there were volunteers to do that, and then build network from that. So such a version was developed, a number of other scenarios as well, but this was the main scenario. It was then written into a report that went to the city for political decisions. And at the third meeting, there were some key other very strong actors in this. One was a leading politician, and another was the most influential, strongest capital owner in the city of Malmö. Made his millions when the IT industry was booming. Turned out that when this came up to the politicians or in the civil servants, I'll back out. The last meeting, they were not there anymore. So it turned out they decided that they did not like this idea. So instead of staying there and saying they don't like this idea, they just opted out. They left the whole thing. So when we meet with the politicians and the civil servants, they turn up and they say that they have another idea for how a social incubator should be done. It should be done as an incubator, as should be a job incubator. It should be located. It should be a facility, a manned facility. It should be located out in Rosengård or in the neighborhood, and it should work business as usual in the sense that people out there could come with a business idea. They would help to develop a business plan, and if it was a strong enough idea, business plan, then there would be some seed money for it, and they could raise capital for that. So, to cut a long story short. With lots of back and forth, that was what happened, with quite a substantial support from the city and from EU with money to do this. So instead of the distributor incubator out there, you got a very traditional job incubator. Only difference was that it was located in Rosengård. And I mean, so it highlights some of the problems of. If you want to have different actors together, actors with very different agendas, you also have to find ways to have them to stay, not to opt out. So that's one of the challenges with agonism, as we were talking about. So in that sense, it was a failure, the whole project. And then it's a long story that goes in different directions. But and again, I think this is the core of the kind of infrastructure in the living labs that we work with. That a month ago, this came up again in a new workshop, in a newer, a little bit different setting, but this time it seems like it will probably work. So it is this of not giving up. You're coming back. I've described it sometimes as melancholic design. You do these things, a lot of people get engaged, they get actually very mad and sad if it doesn't work, of course, but you just hang in, keep on building these networks, and next time maybe there is a little bit more success. So that's where the importance of the long-termness in this comes in.
I was curious about distributed incubator. How could you? That would mean different, multiple places. How does that?
I think that, as I remember it, it's in the report. You would probably have some kind of office or some kind of offices, but this would just. The important thing would be that there are people that live in these areas, that have experience, that build the network and are the contact persons and work actively in their suburb. And they then also have contacts to investors, to the university, to design labs, to whatever there is. But they build the networks. They are the locus from which the networks are being built. So I mean, it's not such a strange idea. I think we have it in many other areas. It was never developed in enough detail. So it could well be that it has its flaws. But I think the interesting thing is that. There was a very strong agreement upon this, but the strongest player did not agree. Hence, it did not happen. Yeah, and here's the Women's Association. Time goes quick. So I think I'll say less about it this time because now we start to run out of time. But this was a group that
we made contact with through the work with the youngster in the hip hop organization. They put us in contact with this group of women from 200 women from Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Bosnia, who almost all are on don't have a job, so they are on welfare money, but many of them are not very fluent in Swedish language, but they have a lot of other competences, and so a broad brainstorming about what could they do ended up with a number of ideas, but one of the big ideas was that maybe they could cater and this is not a good picture for this. This picture is better. Would there be a way where their competences could come in play in providing services for unaccompanied refugee children? In Malmö, there's a real big inflow of people, of unaccompanied refugee children coming in. And they're not staying in Malmö. They are there for 3 months or 6 months or sometimes longer, and then are being moved on. But the question was, could they, with their cooking skills, with their language skills, with their cultural skills, provide this service for and the, you say the role of the designer in this, besides trying to work out such an be part of working out such an idea, has very practical things of not as a designer, but as someone from the university. They can walk up to the city and say that this idea that these women have, we would very much like to collaborate with, we think it's a great idea, because before that the city had not wanted to talk to them at all. So you bring some legitimacy to it, but the city says that, oh yeah, okay, that could be, we could try that, but not with one of the centers that we are responsible for. So we were hooked up after the prototyping process with a company that a private company that that facilitates and housed a group of unaccompanied refugee children. There were done experiments with this, and I think it was quite successful, but in terms of resources, this was beyond what this other company was willing to invest in. And so to try to develop the business model further, it was organized this meeting between the network of women entrepreneurs in the south of Sweden and this group, and we were then put on the sign, not part of the process at the time, and for them to find out or refine the business ideas that their communities.
You focused on strengthening the skills that they already had, so the cooking skills, the Living Lab focus on strengthening the weaknesses of these groups? And also, why this group in particular?
That's a good question. I think one strategy, and that might be a weakness, I don't know, but it's... in our work, we've always tried to say to focus on capabilities.
on people's capabilities rather on than on weaknesses. That here is something that could be built upon, and you could say that you can question that, but that has really been a basis in almost all the work to say that actually people know something, they have some skills. Could something be built on that and work further on? And why this group? It could very well have been another group. I think that, this is more of a research strategy. I think for us, because we're also researchers, we have always, we've been more interested in high-hanging fruit than low-hanging fruits. So where the general wisdom is to go where success is quite likely with low-hanging fruits, we have thought that, since this is also research, where is the border, where is the limit to where things could be. So in that sense, because there was another very established women's group in the same neighborhood, which had a lot of support from the city, and does great work, but were already part of the establishment. They were actually doing very well. Whereas this group were marginalized in a quite different way by the city. They were not seen as a resource. I don't know if that answers your.
I was thinking this is quite interesting because on one hand you do research, so you're trying to find out what works best or what are the causes or whatever, but that on the other hand you try to improve the living conditions of these people, so this is, so you're
really close to
the topic of the...
Yeah, but that's a fair. I mean, there's a lot of ethics in this, and I don't think there are easy answers. But I guess you're right. The idea of not focusing on low hanging fruit, as the general wisdom says you should do, is motivated in many ways by this also being research, being university based, and trying beyond what we already know that works. It's quite interesting because not specifically with our projects, but there's been quite a debate in Sweden also about not least in Rosengård, this area. It's the highest experimented area in Sweden. They are so tired of projects because projects are short money, it lights up a little bit, and the researchers get a chance to write their reports and books, and then things are back to normal. So there is this dilemma in it, I think I would not say that we are not part of that as well. The only difference is that, or if there is a difference, is that not least in Rosengård, but I think in Overlab, it's been built on long-term relations. It's not been built on the one project, but building trust relations over much, much longer time. And being clear about that, as researchers, we also have an agenda trying to understand what are emerging possibilities in how to deal with these issues. But
Belle, this is a sidetrack, but came to my mind. I would like to listen to your take on this. So I met Anthony Dune some years ago. And he's the one of the pioneers in critical design. But one specific project, the placebo project, then he not only designed an object that is critical, but he also went observed how people use this object at home and what were their feelings and if they developed anything, any critical perspective. And I think it was a quite open approach to that. They didn't push the critical thing. They just let the object stay at their homes and then see first the people reflect on it. But I asked him, so why didn't do that anything like that afterwards? That was only placebo. And then he said, designers, you know, they like to make things once. And once they do it, they want to do something else new. They are always in the verge of trying something new. And it's enough to have done once. Someone else can do it in the permanent, but designers are always striving for new things, trying new things.
Yeah.
How do you engage in designers in this kind of long-term projects that does not seem to be very flashy? I don't know.
Yeah, I think, I don't know, but I think, for instance, that our group has existed with the new people coming to it, but not so many leaving it. It's been going on since when we started in 98. Okay. So let me take placebo project and critical design versus another case that is not this case, but more parallel in time to when Tony Dunn and Fiona Raby did the placebo project. The placebo project was basis also for Tony Dunn's design PhD, one of the first in maybe we can call it interaction design, Hertz and Tails. But what they did was very inspiring for many of us, though long-term disappointing in a sense. It's a really interesting strategy. It's basically an artistic strategy of advertising these objects that people can borrow or care for over a period of time, and then they come out, do interviews, and then these are kind of fancy critical objects that could make you reflect on your everyday. And then they do a book and they do an exhibition at Victoria and Albert, and it gets some media coverage, but not much. So that's one way to look at critical design. It's like saying, okay, in one way, open up questions of the frontier of the future, but it's not very participative. It's critical in the traditional meaning of critical, trying to raise question about should it really be like this, rather than what we would call compositional, borrowing a term from Latour, in the sense that you actually try to make a difference. And so about the same time, some of the colleagues were working with nurses in the hospital, with staff in an intensive care unit in a hospital. This was when we had something called PDAs, personal digital assistants. There was the new technology that was very fancy. From doing ethnographies there, they found out that one of the areas where one maybe could work was with informal learning, how to operate a machine, how to fix a bandage, because there are manuals for everything, but you don't have time to read the manual when it breaks down. So the idea came up to do a set of little films, amateur films, you could say, that they shoot themselves, people at the ward, on telling of how to deal with that situation. So there'll be a colleague that, so it's going to be a 90 seconds or whatever, long film. And then there would have a board where there also will be medical doctors who either reacted or accepted or demanded changes from a medical perspective. And then it was put up on the server, and then there was a barcode. This was the time of the barcodes. Sitting by a machine, for instance. And on the PDA, there will be a barcode reader. So I have a problem. I go and get the PDA, which would be the mobile phone today, of course. And I get a colleague who gave me some hints on how to deal with this. And there were hundreds of such films being made. It was a great success. And it was awarded... got a number of awards, but it was awarded best, something called the Users Award in Sweden, which is nominated by people in different organizations. They can nominate whether. So this was nominated and awarded. And the interesting thing is that when the prize was given out, Erling and Per Anders, they were not even invited. It were the nurses that were there to, and I think that this is really interesting of how of course they got their acknowledgement and they got their PhDs, so they should be happy in many ways anyway. But where's Fiona and Tony? They're kind of with the books on what do they call dark. I don't remember now. Not only his thesis, but they had this. Yeah, there's a book on these experiments, which kind of an art book.
Design noir,
exactly, design noir. So I know what I prefer, but I'm not saying that you should. And then there is another take on critical design by the Goldsmith people, which I. On what they call sustainable, speculative design, which tries to be similar but tries to be closer to everyday practices and activities, but always building something that is beyond the front line, as we know it, at the group of Bill Gabers and others. Was that an answer to that question?
Yeah, there was just how to engage designers with things that are not new.
And that's what I'm saying. Maybe it takes a certain. I mean, Erling and Per Anders, they have stayed on since that. They both trained as artists before they get into interaction design, this kind of design is. Is what they prefer to do. And when coming to others like Anna Seravalli, who we'll talk about in a bit, who trained in Milano as industrial designer, she did her PhD with us, she's staying on and doing, this kind of not so glorious design. Yeah. And
is there also the question, what is innovation?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you see as innovation? Yeah.
What do you value? Innovation.
Yeah, but is it small steps, or is it something completely different from what is already there?
Yeah.
Is it innovation in the practice of using? Is that the innovation
or? No, I think you're right.
So that's also a discussion.
Yeah.
It depends who you are.
Yeah. I think we. We will come back to that example on the 11th. So I just think we, in terms of looking at the watch, that we should move on. So to the next field, which is maybe easier to understand design-wise, the area of makerspaces, fab labs. Etc. Here there are the bases are three cases. One is Fabriken that we talked about, and that makerspace. Another case is about more an artistic community, technical artistic community that is self-organized and that work with public installations, basically large-scale public installations, and it says maybe more about how can you work informally in doing actually quite big projects and across competence, something that needs really high technical competence, design competence, and also artistic competence, and what are some of the constraints and problems in this. And the last case is about the open hardware platform Arduino, which is, if it's not the standard, but it's one of the key open platforms for open hardware, and it was developed by David Quartieles, who also stayed working with us for all years, never finished his PhD, but has and I mean, traveling the world with Arduino and the idea of open hardware and on the during the late and first as a tool for artists and designers to have access to building stuff, and later on much more focusing on preschool learning. But the story he tells is about is a political story about open open hardware and how the those who argue for open production and open hardware and actually get deeply into it, start open open platforms and companies around that, when it comes too much money into it, closes it down and made it proprietary instead. So it tells this really, really, really inside story. It's not a scientific paper. It's a love story, as you call it. How deep is your love? It's called. But it's, I think it's kind of interesting because it has the details how deep your love is for openness and free. And you can read that when you come. But as a background for this area, I think that we have participatory design in some way, but the real background is for openness is back to the GNU project in 83-84 and the idea of free and liberal open software. And maybe we can also say that in the 70s, there were things embryos to what we today think about as makerspaces. There were workshops in different kinds, not least in Holland, actually. There were the science workshops where university opened up university from the university workshops where people could come and produce and get support from students and faculty on this. It's quite interesting, actually. But so that's the background. So what are some of the conditions people are arguing for this? One is that with the internet and other tools and techniques, we can now have peer-to-peer production. We don't have to go via a corporation. So that's one of the basic ideas. The existence of tools and techniques that can make it possible for us to build peer-to-peer networks. The main question that comes up has to do with, is this empowerment or is it or when is it to profit from free labor, so to say? Who, so like in the question of open hardware and partly what Arduino was part of, the drones that
that Anderson's company were building. The question becomes, are people really empowered by all these tools, or is there someone else that profit from it? And when time is right, for instance, closes down the openness, or crowdsources it into a company and there's been free labor that's not being paid for. So this is there's this spectrum of how this is organized, this team discussed. Another question that's being discussed in terms of openness is, it was called open, it was called free from the beginning, but with Linux, it's changed to open to, in a way, depoliticize it. Not because free had other connotations of the access to it, and this is not to diminish the importance of Torvalds' work and Linux, but just to say that there was a shift there in perspective, at least all the authors here are. And lately we've started to have also ideas about open design that's coming. There are books produced about it. And basically it's practical experience, not much theoretical yet, but there are a growing movement around it. Typically, there would be physical lab spaces, places to do this, like this place. Call them fab lab, hacker spaces, maker spaces, or whatever. But where you have access to tools that makes it possible for you to actually build a prototype of a product with an idea that you have. So, one in the chapters, one of the ideas that's being tested there is, if we believe, or if one wants to see, or if one wants to try out, if this kind of makerspaces could be a challenge to production as we have known it, to something that could be more bottom up but still sustainable. Is there any kind of socio-economic model that could support that? And one of the basic ideas that's been brought up is the idea of commons. And you'll read quite a lot about that when you come. So, and the concept of commons theorized, I guess, starts out with Eleanor Ostrom's work on common resources, like a lake, for instance, and the maintenance of that. That's not owned by anyone, but it's also been developed in the era of information technology by a number of scholars and practitioners that also have to do with how we produce collaboratively. And so it's a way to look differently at ownership. And very, very shortly, so in the production, if we can talk about production, there is some kind of collaboration around shared resources that are maybe not free, but are shared access to them. There's some kind of self-governed networks around it. It's not geared into to one company, and the results are in some way freely accessible. So how they circulate. So how can such an economy work, and can it work? And how does it work together with market economy, or and can it be sustainable? For instance, questions of sustainability when you go into materials like the one we have around here, not only software, can one take for given that local production actually is sustainable when it comes to the use of materials, and there's also a limitation in the use of the machinery, in the sense that you can have
how many copies does you want of a computer program at the same time, whereas a 3D printer, even if it can make other 3D printers, at the moment where you have it, you only got the one or the three or how many you now have. So there's scarce resources in that. There's a number of problems that are a little bit different. I won't go through everything, but for instance, one thing comes up here, and that has to do with if you're working in a makerspace with this kind of commons environment, how do you deal with questions of safety, for instance? Who is responsible for if someone got badly burnt or cut or whatever in there? So how do you deal with these kind of issues in a commons in a maker commons? Just to take one of these issues that bring brought up. Finally, I think Anna Saravalli, who has maybe the most theoretically elaborate chapter here on Fabriken, she also tries to show how making and commons go together in what she called commons making, understood both as the making of the common. You're all the time making the common, but it's also commons that make. What is special about that kind of infrastructure? And I'll bring Anna's thesis with me next time. So if some of you are interested in this, to do work in this area, you can borrow that one from me to have more detail. I don't know how we should do. I think we should need a little break, or what? Just a short break, and then we do the last. Or do you rather want to go on? Short break. No. I don't know what happened to time. I thought we only had material for 1 hour. Other
parts of it,
it has the hub, like just like here. Isn't there a hub? Or is this the hub or here? It has an electronic workshop, it's a big bicycle kitchen, it has the granny's workshop, this is the textile corner, it hosts and what becomes startups, like here's a startup that reuse material and try to, and then do teaching with children to understand material and sustainability. Things that this can be part of it, even if it seems to be quite long from technology. Maybe stop 1 second at this picture and talk to someone about it. These are pictures that Anna Saravalli has been taking. Focusing on that, oh yes, you make prototypes and have all that kinds of collaboration, but literally you also make the space. And that's part of the designer's contribution, to have design skills that are not only design thinking or visualizing or prototyping, but also contributing in the here and now. There is a furniture that needs to be fixed or whatever. That's an interesting point. I think we just jumped it. We'll take it next time. And when we discuss it in the end, this is, you could say, in many ways, Fabrikenstapeln is a great success. It still survives, it's got more and more people coming there. It's not only hackers at all anymore. But a couple of years ago, we had quite a criticism for it because there was not enough companies coming there, even if there were companies created. So our management at the research center decided that we should set up a new lab
and at the university, like this, it was called Connected to Lab, and she worked with the Internet of Things, basically, and was a lot of resources channeled over from Fabriken to this, and it was a big opening with 300 people, and party and drinks, and good music, and very important guests being brought in to do seminar, etc. And it did not attract companies to come. Almost no companies. It got closed down very, very, very quick. The whole idea just didn't work. Our director left her job and moved on to back to Lund. But that's another story. So it's interesting to see what are that's what Anna is analyzing as well. What are the conditions for something to be a lively, workable makerspace? Can you and even if you seem to be doing it right, and hopefully you are doing it right here, it can be quite difficult. It's maybe not so. Because one of the things that happened here, and maybe I should say that's also part why it broke down, that the researchers did not want to participate because they thought that this was only a commercial setup and there were no research questions to work with. And the designers, they could just as well work at a design company and get better paid for doing this. So there was a clash of interests. Hopefully not happening here. Yeah. But the other cases we drop. Next area is cultural production. Culture design and culture production, or the field of culture production, I don't know where to start, but I mean, we theoretically probably go back to Adorno and Hochheimer and others, and in the trying to understand the politics of how culture is being made. I'll not go into details about that. But what the chapters here try to deal with is what happens when we go from the idea of culture production to creative industries to innovation. Today, you do not that often talk about cultural production anymore. You talk about creative industries. Creative industries is also, again, a concept linked, you could say, to Triple Helix and others, but invented in the UK as thinking that, in the broad sense, artists, architects, designers, entrepreneurs in new startups, professionals, professors, etc., are the creative class. And this creative class, it's important to attract this creative class to cities, and because they make up the creative industries, and it's for any city to it is important to be able to attract, as Florida would say, the creative class to be able to develop the creative industries. And the creative industries are then thought of as one of the main engines in economic production. So culture production in many ways become economic production, and that's part of the changes here. Any city would have, like Malmö, a harbour area. You cannot have a harbour area here, but then you have something else, I'm sure, that there were used to be factories, and it's being made attractive for the creative class to move in there and set up companies and have close proximity between jobs and work and knowledge institutions like universities, etc. So any city that can brand itself as that can attract people and then grow economically. But then again, the question here is in terms of democratization, does this have to do with an elite, a competitive elite that works on the market with others, or are the broader issues involved, like some kind of heterogeneous bottom-up networks of actors that, because the creative class seems to be very divided between, on the one hand, the core, as Richard Florida described, which are us and the artists and a few others, and some very much more mundane everyday culture producers. The chapter sees I try to look at media tactics in public space. They does an interesting in one of the chapters an interesting shift of perspective or drift of perspective, trying to look beyond infrastructure as been described in the beginning of the book, more working towards a vision of Deleuze and Guattari on the rhizomes, you know, these mushroom networks, and colliding, intersecting rhizomes is being generated as an possibly alternative understanding of it, because it also looks at the importance of trying to understand what is the relation between the bottom-up activities and, for instance, state financing or city financing or central body like national television in Sweden and so on. Try to see how does this play in very practical projects that you do. And it also tries to, a little bit like with the makerspaces and commons, try to argue for that with these small cultural producers, they cannot afford and do not have time for long prototyping and research and development processes. It has to be sharp production now. That's the only thing. So that also changes the design intervention. The two cases here, one looks at different forms for grassroots journalism and the conditions for that, and the other one look at a filmmaking, an independent filmmaking company, very, very small, and their story through and media tactics and how they can finance production and how they can collaborate with their audience. So we will not be able to talk about that much now. The fourth and final field we call emerging publics. And if I should look at the background for that, I guess there's the two kinds of background one could. One is the notion from Jürgen Habermas on the public sphere, on that space where the public and the private can meet. But there have over the years been a lot of criticism of this democratic space in the sense that arguing that it's not singular. There are many potential public spaces, public spheres. There are many potential publics. And one of the key issues that's being brought up here is the question of if there are many publics, how do publics then emerge? And many scholars in design and in science and technology studies would go back to John Dewey's understanding of publics and his democratic writings, where publics are something the people that come together in different ways because the institutions that we have are not able to take care of the problems at stake.
So you gather, you find a way to gather that goes beyond, say, the parliament in the broader sense. So the question for design here then becomes, can design be part of these emerging publics, not only be part of, say, the parliament or the constitution as known, but have a special interest in participating in activities which do not have workable institutions. Another aspect that comes up in these chapters has to do with the making of public space, and with the making in public space, and with that trying to, as with the makerspaces or fab labs, etc., also try to understand something about is there a relation between design as making and decision making, for instance? What kind of decision making does it come from making? There's one chapter we'll talk about in a minute that really does that in an interesting way. It does introduce, it looks at, you know, this thinging or infrastructuring that goes from assembly to object to assembly. The way it looks at the object, you could say, is as a boundary infrastructuring, as something that is, instead of using words like platforms, etc., but something that opens up the public space for activity that is not scripted or made clear, but opens opportunities. And there's also the more traditional aspect of how people appropriate it, how it make it there, and by that open it up in assembly and then again in the object. And there are three cases here. The first case, look at how young people, so some of them from the movement of the face and voice of the street, how they appropriate places that are often seen as dangerous, etc. And there are examples of a group of skating girls, you can call them girls, not women, that also try to make in different ways the city into a different, city spaces into different spaces. And exactly how design can apply that, I'm not sure, but that we'll discuss in the last example when we come that far. Then there is a second chapter. Maybe we can look at this. So to look a bit at how this infrastructuring works. So we have this movement, the face and voice of the street, and together with them start to build a repertoire of expressions using some of the new technologies that we have. This is quite far back in time. Doing workshops with them, coming up with the idea of the bus, and by that starting to, so it started out at Incons. Do you remember this cultural hub? But now that's not central to it anymore. Comes in the NGO, an interaction design company, a technical company, the bus company. Those who deliver vehicles to the bus company, and so on. And a new project comes out of it that we call Blue Prumo, and again around that there will be more built up. And then when it goes into this game, again you'll see networks that are expanding and that makes this possible all the way through. Yeah. So that's
that's how over time these networks are being associated and in this infrastructure strategy. And here is from. The crafting issues case is a case of trying to see if there are very low key, low speed publics, making publics that can be part of the repertoire of our democratic expression. It's basically a traveling string circle where people bring their mobile phone text messages, embroider them, or have them printed on a sewing machine. But so there is no issue to start with. But in the making, the issues come out like. Like someone is embroidering this text message in one of the sewing circle. Okay, very little information. I want to know more. Okay, call you. She lives 60 kilometers west Tokyo. And so this is a woman that has this text message in her mobile phone, and embroideries and it's. She has a daughter that lives in Tokyo, and this is when there had been the nuclear power plant disaster, and she wants to get known. And suddenly Tokyo and that disaster becomes part an issue for this public to discuss and try to understand. For instance, questions of security, etc. And so you can discuss, is this kind of very slow emerging issues, is that worth discussing? Or as when they did this once in Helsinki in Finland, and this guy come up and say, why don't you let a Chinese worker do this instead? It would be much cheaper. So we come with in comes questions of production and geopolitics, etc. So it's small issues that arises all the time from it, and they're collected over time, literally traveling these boxes from place to place. And the third case is something that looks like a straightforward success story. It's the design of you could say mobile video, direct transmission, so television for the poor, for the everyday. And the example is a Mambuser, a service that was developed. Now it's a couple of years ago. But it became very important, and it was basically developed as a way where people could afford to shoot to live stream video with their mobile phones, and the idea from those who did it was that this was part of a democratizing society, making those tools available to everyone, and it played a quite important role both at the Tahrir Square and in other places during the Arab Spring, in terms of making it possible for some kind of surveillance instead of surveillance, so that people could actually send from the grassroots level send pictures of what was happening. But the chapter also discusses the problem of lot of unintended consequences, like, for instance, how those who were broadcasting from the Tahrir Square, they were also very easy targets for the government to see. So they were also mapped out. So that's, it's complicated. Complicated. It's not so easy just to do a smart technology without understanding how it potentially can be appropriated, etc. I mean, and not that you can, and this was a great story in many ways, but it's not. It's just trying to reflect upon how do you know? Maybe it was not so nice for those guys that were spotted by the military. So these are the last types of cases, trying to look at different ways of opening up the public space. So, in summary then, in some way, I think we've seen this one before, I think that throughout the book, with the examples of these four areas, there is some kind of idea emerging that where public space has become a production space where we actually are doing things, a lot of it maybe being crowdsourced, etc., and that makes it interesting for us to, in the perspective of democracy, to try to look at other models like those based on commons or new publics. That a perspective of technological innovation maybe have to be replaced by an idea of many here and now, multiple futures being imagined and made in the here and now by a very heterogeneous group of actors with no center, and definitely not only the Silicon Valley Center. That small contribution as it might be, that it could be wise not only to focus on to hold marginal costs, but more on engaging with marginal resources in society. And with innovation, that maybe it's not necessary to have to do so much with the new, but more with the well-composed or the slow. And finally, and I think this is where we'll struggle, is that as maybe there's also a shift in perspective from the designer as in participatory design, helping the user to get the product or service that they want, to try to understand that we are part of some kind of participatory citizenship that where there is a much more leveled, out-leveled and heterogeneous group of actors where who is the designer is not that obvious. And for participatory design, co-design, a change from the idea of getting ordinary people into the design to see if the design and design competence you have can be part of the everyday life of citizens, wherever they live and work, etc. So, with that said, that was the much quicker summary than planned of the themes. But we go back. The way we're going to work with this from now on is that the next time, on Wednesday next week, we're going to have our first critical seminar. And for that, we'll work on social design or conditions for
designing conditions for the social.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Pelle, but what is, do we have a lecture also on Monday?
No.
Oh, okay.
I don't know why, but we don't. I'm here, but we don't.
So this is the next lecture then?
This is the next lecture. And it's not a lecture. It's a seminar.
Okay.
So you will all have to have read chapter 2, which is the introductory chapter for this, and chapters 3 and 4. And you have these kind of questions. It's on the blackboard, this picture. So, and when you read, try to prepare reflections on these kind of questions. So it will not be driven as a lecture. I'll do some little introduction because it's the first time, but we're supposed to sit and discuss the texts and your reflection on them, and your critical reflection on them, for instance, along these lines. So that'll be very different. It will not be preaching. We've done it this way because I understood from Marcia that you're not, some of you at least, are not used to having critical seminars, which is maybe more a tradition in the humanities. But that's what we're going to have. So it's a text that comes and your critique of the text. And everyone reads it, these three chapters for Wednesday, and look at this question, and then we discuss it together. Whereas for the 23rd, which is 23rd of 3rd, it's quite far away, we have the second critical seminar, and there we work with the three other parts of the book, the themes. But that we do in the way that we have, I think we're going to have four groups, and I don't know exactly how we're going to do this, but there will be assignment to one, each group will be responsible for one of the themes, and the rest of us should of course have looked and read, but you will be, each group will be driving open production and give the overview and introduce the discussion and questions, etc. And the same thing for credit class struggles and emerging publics. So this also opens the question of, should we start to formulate groups already now, or would you wait until the 11th or 13th? Because it's this, but then on the 13th we have the so that's also next week. We have the mapping exercise where within one of these four areas that we'll be talking about, you should try to find a challenge, an issue, a controversy that you want to work with, and you have to find out and you have to find it here or with some people that you can work with and start to map out who can the actors be in this and what kind of conflicts could they have, helping you to formulate your interventions that you would do in the coming months. So, okay, this was the wrong picture. Sorry. Critical seminar. Okay, I forgot. We have the critical seminar. We also have the mapping exercise. I didn't bring a picture of the mapping exercise. So that is on the 13th. And then after the critical seminar, after the mapping exercise, you have to start to work on your project. And you can start with it earlier on if you want to, but the mapping exercise can also help you to formulate what intervention it is that you want to engage with. So I don't know if we can talk a little bit, if people have ideas of groups that they would want to be with, or someone that wants to work together, or have you been thinking about anything like that?
What if we discuss first possibilities of, are these groups from the seminars the same as you're going to work with for the mapping exercise and the a democratic design experiment?
I mean, I was thinking that if one got together, I think I'm really interested in the idea of commons and makerspaces, and I think that there are something down in Inchide or some people there that could be brought here, and then I probably want to do my mapping exercise around opening production, and if there are others that are interested in that, they could maybe negotiate an intervention that they want to do.
So it's going to be an individual exercise, the mapping exercise.
That depends on. I mean, the mapping exercise we do in groups. But your question was, is it the same groups? And I'm saying that it could be the groups. It would be great if it's the groups that we do for the mapping exercise. But if it turns out that no, this is nothing for me, I would much rather do work with something around an emerging public or public space. I guess we should make it open that people could shift. What if we make it like this, that you're all thinking about this until Wednesday, when we meet for the mapping exercise, it's not the mapping exercise, when we meet for the critical seminar, so then we discuss again, so it would be good if you, for that, have thought about, I think I would like to work with something in this or that direction, in one of the four areas. And maybe also, if you have some kind of ideas of what it could be here, and then we can make it possible for you to announce that and then negotiate with others.
Yeah, I suggest that we do that on Wednesday.
We do that on Wednesday.
So
yeah.
Everybody brings an issue on a community that has already kind of understanding.
Yeah, that would
and
be
then
great.
Then form groups from these possibilities.
Yeah.
Looks good.
Okay, so those were the practical things. That's why we need to get the groups going. We don't need them for the Wednesday, but we need them after the Wednesday.
But what if not many people read the chapters? Not many people think about those issues. What happens on Wednesday?
I mean, I'm sure you'll try to do it, and it's for some of you it's a new thing. I mean, these are just possible questions to raise, but it's doing two things, like understanding what is it that they are trying to say here. But then start to question it in different way, to try to unpack it. And you're absolutely allowed to disagree and be critical, etc. It's just trying to understand how sustainable is this idea, and what do you think? Maybe it's something for you, and maybe it's not, and maybe you question conclusions and so on. So we will try to understand better what they're trying to say. And I mean, there's a difference between, say, now on chapter 2, which is kind of laying out the theoretical perspective, looking into what has been written about social innovation, etc., and the cases. I'm thinking of when we're coming down here in the groups, probably there'll be different persons that are responsible for different chapters in the preparation. But so it will be much better on the 23rd than on Wednesday. We'll see Wednesday as a kind of prototype for how this could be done. And so I volunteered to do a little bit of the work, but not the whole. Thank you. I don't think, again, it's too late to do the design thinking again. But your questions made, some of the questions made me make some notes, and I think I can help to clear it out a little bit, and then we can talk about that maybe next time also. Yep.
I have a suggestion for Wednesday.
Yeah.
We did that in our course as well.
Mm-hmm.
It was also a kind of critical setup seminar. We wrote statements down.
Yeah.
And maybe that's the starting point for the discussion.
Yeah.
So everybody writes down your statements.
Yeah.
I like
it. Very good. Very good. And excellent. So that's part of the assignment. Yeah, let's see if we can get that up on the blackboard also, to say that everyone has to prepare, say, at least three statements or questions.
Yeah.
Yep.
Like that.
Yeah. Excellent. Is that it? See you Wednesday then.